The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I have for you an absolute treat. I'm going to be interviewing possibly one of the most inspiring, savvy, charming, debonair, insightful chaps that I have the pleasure of knowing. I refer, of course, to myself. Dan, welcome to Brokenomics. Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate the honesty of that introduction, and may I say it's an absolute pleasure to be working with somebody such as yourself. Really look forward to coming on the show. Well, no, thank you for coming on. You're very much an audience favourite, so it seemed only natural to get you on the show, and I'm just delighted that you could be here, that you could make the time slot. So, look, Dan, you're simply a fascinating person to speak to, but really what I wanted to try and get at in this interview is I wanted to find out about you, and more to the point, we get lots of questions on Brokenomics about how it is that you put your thesis together, your framework, how it is that you look at markets and how it is you understand it. And I kind of wanted to get to the bottom of how it is that you have come to see the world in this way, and as well as just, you know, finding out a little bit more about you, because you are, quite honestly, an endlessly fascinating person, and I think we'd just like to hear your story. So, you know, if it's all right with you, why don't we just get your journey? Well, yes, sure, Dan. Yeah, I mean, I'd be perfectly happy to go through that. So, I'll just kick off then, shall I? Well, right, my journey. Where to begin? Let's start with the earliest days. I have to give a special hat tip to my good old dad. Good chap he is. He is a boomer, but he's actually quite based and very, very sensible. So it's all kind of okay. Some of my earliest memories is, you know, he would present me with newspaper headlines or something like that, of something that the that the government was doing, or the Labour Party was doing, or something like that, and their various plans. And he would say, "Well, what do you think of that then, boy?" And I was, these would tend to be fairly, you know, right leaning biased tabloids. So I mean, I'd look at the framing of it, and of course, you know, when you're 6 years old, you just think, well, that sounds very silly indeed. I don't like that. So I'd say, you know, well, that doesn't seem very sensible, Dad. I don't seem to like these Labour people. And he would then give me a very broad smile and, you know, rub on the head and say, "Well done, boy. I'm glad I'm not raising a bloody socialist." So, yes, the reason I have to thank him for that is because I never went through that phase that most people do of starting out a bit lefty and then getting more right wing as you get older. My good old man, he made sure that I was, right on the right from basically day one, which I think saved me a lot of time. So that was, very much appreciated. Thanks, Dad, for that. Again, early in my sort of political journey, my best friend when I was a little kid was a socialist. I don't think it was really his fault. His parents were socialists, so you sort of have to forgive him for this. And I like arguing a lot with basically anyone I can get. I mean, shopkeepers if I need to, but, you know, ideally with You know, an intellectual equal is good fun. So we would spend many an hours arguing about political concepts that we barely understood, and that was jolly good fun. And I was able to sort of take the right wing position, and he could take the socialist position. But you know, back in those days, I mean, this is, well, whatever it is, 40 odd years ago, you could be a right winger and socialist and still be friends. That was possible in a way that it's not today. He's now completed his journey. He's now very based and on the right, but he did the thing that most people do, which is to sort of get there by experience rather than having it drilled into it at a young age. Schooling, I was also a fairly argumentative child at school. To be fair, although in my mind it was not being argumentative, I was simply pointing out the logical fallacies in the assertions that the various teaching staff were making. This was sort of spelt out to me one time when we had a new teacher assigned to the school, and I asked the first question, and he immediately said, "What's your name?" And I told him, and he said, "Ah, yes, I was warned about you." And I asked if he was warned about anyone else in the school of whatever it was, 350 something people, and he was told, no, I was just warned about you. So yes, but a good argument is the basis of so much. Growing up in the 80s, the key difference that the younger ones of you might not realize is just how boring being a child in that period was, because we didn't have the interweb. We did have TV channels, but unless it was between like 3 and 4:30, there wasn't any sort of programming that you would find even remotely interesting. So bored quite a lot. So I read a lot as a young chap. So I sort of finished off every book in the house, which to be fair didn't take that long. And then I would just, you know, from a young age, as soon as I could ride a bike, go into town, get 5 books a week. Take them home, read them, swap them out the next week. So I read a lot. In fact, I was a bit like my granddad in that respect. Dear old granddad, not with us anymore, but he had whole rooms literally stacked up to the door, deep in books, because he consumed so many books. I've been a bit like that. I'll tell you a quick granddad story while we're on the granddad, because He was quite the man, was old Jim. He was in the war, and so he enlisted, went off to, you know, serve king and country and all of that. And was it a queen at the time? I forget. Anyway, no, it was king at the time. And he rose through the ranks to sergeant major fairly quickly. And he was in the North Italian campaign, and the Americans basically shared a base with the Brits. At one point, some American patrol had gone off, and they'd managed to get their hands on a Luger, and the famous German gun, and they were sort of, you know, trying it out. They'd lined up some beer bottles, a couple of hundred feet away, and were trying to hit them with a Luger. Anyway, so Grandad walks past, and they're like, "Hey, Sergeant Major, come and try this." So he takes the gun, and he said it was so heavy he could barely lift the bloody thing. So he kind of kept it low and then just swung it up and fired off a shot as he swung it up, and then sort of carried on swinging it up to some sort of, you know, James Bond pose. And by sheer fluke, he managed to take the bottle cap off the top of the beer bottle and leave the beer bottle standing on the wall. So they were absolutely amazed, and sort of immediately asked him to do it again. And he sort of just casually mentioned, "Oh, no, I'm far too busy," and sort of, you know, hurried off because, of course, he knew he could never replicate that shot ever again. But he was treated like something of an action hero on base after that. So, good old grandparents. But anyway, no, back to me. Read a lot as a kid. Don't read much anymore. Because basically back in those days, you just didn't have really any option. You know, what else were you going to do? I mean, you can muck around with your mates for a bit, but you know, winter's evenings on a school night, you know, there's not really an awful lot you can do. So read a lot. Don't really lock anymore, because, you know, these days you've got so many other options. I mean, you can go on YouTube and watch the Lotus Eaters or Brokenomics on lotuseaters.com. You know, I spend a lot of time these days interacting with the AI programs, just drilling down into an issue. So for me now, a typical day when I'm not doing something else is I'll line up a series of YouTube videos, just bang through them at double speed while I'm conversing with, you know, one of the AI programs on something, you know, whatever it was. The last topic I got into was theoretical advancements in metallurgy, which for some reason, you know, piqued my interest on that particular day. So, you know, these days I probably barely read a book a week, to be honest. Guys in there are very good. Books everywhere. Back in the Lotus Eaters office, Harry and Beau in particular. So Harry's desk is just piles of books and a little space for a little piddly laptop thing in the middle. And then Beau sits in the corner next to me, and he's basically got like three bookshelves which are full, and then he's piling up on top as well. So yeah, very, very bookish people around here. But yeah, no, like I said, I barely get through one a week at the moment. More about me early on. Dad was doing well. He was he had a business which he started up and was building it up. But parents were divorced because they were baby boomers. And if you've ever met a baby boomer, they're always divorced. You know, even if they don't need to, they're just divorced. So lived with my mum, and she was a nurse, and we were quite poor, very poor actually. Growing up, very poor. And I basically concluded that I didn't like it. It wasn't for me. Resolved that this state of affairs was not going to stay in place because, you know, didn't suit me. I suppose you could say I was proto-trans rich, even at that early age. So anyway, me and this aforementioned pal of mine, from sort of eight or so, we got this car washing business going. You know, we managed to get a couple of buckets, brushes, and a bottle of car wash thing, and basically we would just walk around the more affluent neighbourhoods of town, knocking on doors, offering to wash their car for £5 a pop, which was a bit expensive. You know, especially back then in whatever that was, early 90s or late 80s, I forget now. I mean, these days you can get your car done at one of those, you know, whirly brush things for £5. So, you know, inflation adjusted, that would have been a fair bit back then. But I think people just appreciated seeing a youngster being industrious. So, you know, most of them just kind of went for it. And, you know, we'd often finish the day, you know, with somewhere between £100 and £200 in our pocket. You know, split two ways, you know, you'd often end up with like 75, 80 quid for a day's work, which when you're eight and you're living in the late 80s, I mean, it's a lot of bloody money. And yeah, I like this. That was very good. So did that for a while. And then I got into the fast food business. So when I was, what was it, about 13 or so, shot up because there was no seed oils back then. So I hit, you know, whatever it was, 6 foot something by sort of 12, 13 or so. So I lied about my age and went and worked in one of those, you know, fast food places. Again, sort of very industrious, worked lots of hours. I wasn't that far off a full, even though I was part-time and just sort of doing it evenings and weekends, I wasn't that far off full-time hours. So again, when you're young, when you're a early teenager, you know, that was reasonably good money, even though it was a bloody fast food place. And I used to do the what they call the night porting. You know, when you sort of basically take the machine that does the burgers, you take it apart and clean that, and then put it back together again, because it was basically you got paid extra, and you got lots of hours. That way, reliably. So yes, did that for a while. Schooling, did did perfectly well at GCSEs and A levels, and then I elected to go to Southampton University for the simple reason that it was the only Ivy League university within a short enough distance to home that I could drive back at the weekend to get my washing done for me. So probably wasn't the best criteria, but I could also go back. And by then I'd moved on to, working in, one of those shops where they sell TVs and washing machines and stereos and all that sort of stuff. So I could come back there and work at the weekend and earn some money, because quite liked earning money. I had bought myself a car when I was 17, and most people didn't have one, and so that was all good. And I basically liked being able to do whatever the hell I wanted to do. So I did that. I was quite good at the sales thing. Yeah, I was very good at this. So again, with that, I would usually be the top earner in the store, even though I was only working weekends, and the full-time staff would work an extra 3 or 4 days on top of it, because of the because you got a little bit of commission, and I basically sold loads. I started to realise that, because what most people do in shops like these is they kind of wait for somebody to call them over, or they go around aimlessly asking, "Can I help? Are you just browsing?" Something like that. But people who are seriously interested in buying something, they've got a different set of behavioural characteristics. If you look at it enough, you can see that they just behave differently. So I basically figured out what the sort of subtle behavioural clues were, so that I could just sort of stand there in the corner and scan like a hawk, and then when I realised, okay, that person is in the expensive TV section, but they're giving off the wrong signals. It'd be a waste of time. That guy's in the mid-range hi-fi section, and I think he's a buyer. So I'm not going to waste my time on TV man who's just whiling away a Saturday. I'm going to mid-range hi-fi man. So get in there, have the sales technique down, bish bash bosh, get him done, get the next one. Another kill after kill after kill. So found out a bit of an affinity for sales that was great. University itself, it was great fun. Some respects, good bunch of lads there. To be fair though, I did have two major challenges at university. The first one was that, everybody knows this now, that universities are full of insufferable leftists. But this would have been late 90s, and I hadn't quite appreciated that then. We didn't have any social media, remember, back then. So, you just turn up. So I thought, I did this politics and economics course. In my head, what was going to happen on that course is we would sit around and we would discuss why Hong Kong outperforms per capita against bloody Sweden or something, socialist country. What I actually found was that, for example, I had one lecture where the lecturers spent the entire lecture wasting our times reminiscing about the fact that you could literally go and sit in the same chair at the British Library that Karl Marx had once sat in. And he spent a lecture on that, about where it was and the times that he'd sat there and the thoughts that he'd had whilst sitting in the same physical chair as Karl Marx. Now, as you can imagine, not resonating entirely with me. The other aspect of it was that for some reason, academic economists have this massive inferiority complex where they think they should be a science, but clearly they're not. Because, if you get a degree in economics, it's a Bachelor of Science, which should clearly be a Bachelor of Arts, because it's all about making arguments. It's about understanding people and systems and cause and effect. But they wanted it to be a science for whatever reason. So they were endlessly devising more and more complicated formulas to try and basically predict behaviours in economics. And it was a nonsense because, you know, you'd be presented with this massively complicated formula and then, you know, there would be an E in it or something and you'd say, okay, well, what does the E stand for? And that would be, oh, that's human behaviour. But right, well, how do you quantify that then? No, we can't. Right, so what's the point of the equation then? What are you doing? I continued my argumentative streak in my very first, was it the very second, economics lecture. I managed to get hauled up in front of the authorities because basically the lecturer was making the arguments that minimum wage does not increase unemployment. And I was like, well, of course it does. And poor man was trying to give a lecture, a socialist lecture. And I was just arguing with him. It's like, well, look, and I explained all the reasons because basically what a minimum wage does is it doesn't increase the wages of people. It makes it illegal for anyone whose labour is worth less than a certain level to have a job. And he was trying to give me some bloody formula and I was trying to give him real world examples of how it, you know, how it does exactly that. And you've got to factor it. I won't go into the whole bloody thing now. But yeah, so he took my name and that began the, you know, the first time I was reported to the university higher ups for being a bit of a difficult bastard, which to be fair, I had my whole life anyway. So the point is, it didn't actually do that well at university. I mean, I had moments of being good. I mean, if so for example, in the first year, you had to do a statistics course. And apparently on that, I got the highest grade that they had ever had on that course. I scored something like 98.5% or something, which is quite good for an exam. That presumably means I got one question wrong, and I still don't know what it is. But basically, because of this kind of this weird combination of leftist globalist thought combined with this sad attempt to turn economics into a science where clearly it's an art, I just did not connect with it at all. So, you know, I remember at the halfway through the third year getting called into my whatever it is, overseer's office. And he was saying, you do realise you're going to be lucky to scrape a third. Right, which is not good at all. I mean, what's the point of you just completely bloody wasted 3 years if you do that? So yes, wasn't happy with that. So in the last semester of the third year, I kind of pulled it out a bit, and I decided, okay, which is basically what I should have done the entire time, is I decided, oh, I'll just play the bloody game then. I'll just tell them whatever they sodding want to hear. And basically in that last semester of the third year, I was consistently getting high firsts in everything I did, which was enough to take me from the bottom end of a third to most of the way up a 2-2. I would have liked to have got the 2-1, but yeah, it's a bit weak really, isn't it? A 2-2. But I mean, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been a third. So yeah, a bit of a shame. And I really should have been playing the whole game from the beginning. And I think that young students today, I think they understand because they've been pre-warned by social media that when you go to university, it's going to be leftist dogma and crap the whole way through. And you've just got to sort of play along with it. But I didn't know that at the time. So I bristled against it somewhat. So, yeah, university was a bit of a waste of time. And then having a 2-2, that... You know, that shuts you down from going into the upper epsilons of finance jobs, which, you know, I knew I wanted. I knew I wanted a finance job because, as previously established, I like money. And I thought, well, if you want money, why mess around with bloody widgets or something? You know, just go and work directly with the money. So that was a plan. So, yeah. So that was the first challenge of university. The other challenge of university is that I was an ugly bastard. Now, I don't see this much anymore. So presumably new cures have been discovered. But back in the sort of 80s and 90s, if you got acne bad, you know, there was nothing they could do. I mean, you just had to kind of put up with it, to be honest. And so, yes, in a room of 100 people, I would probably be the ugliest person, 100 out of 100. You know, I look like I'd been infected by Nurgle. I look like I had, head-butted my way through the display cabinet at the Wuhan lab. It was annoying because there really wasn't a damn bloody thing you could do about it. You just kind of had to wait for, you know, to get older and for it to go away. So that was very irritating. And the reason it irritated me the most is because universities are full of 19 and 20-year-old young women everywhere. And I was an absolute state, which was no good. So I did what I could in those circumstances, went to the gym a lot. And then my plan was that through a combination of tight T-shirts, dubious nightclub lighting, really working on perfecting my game, I could squeeze through with the minimum acceptable level of Panani for those 3 years, and just about managed that. So managed to get through it. But no, those were wasted years against the potential. Lean years. But you everybody faces adversity in life, and I think that was mine. Right, so, finished university, decided that I wanted to work in finance, very good, lacked the degree because I hadn't been playing that whole game thing correctly, probably should have done it. So I thought, I'll do politics then. So I'd been involved in party politics a bit, and it just so happened that when I was coming out of university, there was a leadership challenge for the Conservative Party. Yes, don't judge. I was a member back then, and if you are old enough to remember, it was Michael Portillo was going for the leadership up against Ken Clark and in Duncan Smith, and Portillo was the chap who had all the charisma and energy, and I thought, okay, well he's a sensible type, so I sort of networked my way into that. And basically, he had this on Barton Street, which is a street just around the corner from Parliament. Very nice house. Apparently, it was worth 12 million at the time, but it would probably be worth 80, if not a lot more, today. This guy had basically given over his house as the sort of campaign hub for this Portillo chap. So, yes, went and worked there. And however long it was, maybe it was 2 months, that sort of leadership campaign, something like that. It was interesting. Got to meet lots of interesting people. I'm trying to figure out if I met Rupert Lowe there. Was Rupert Lowe a Conservative back then? The reason I ask is because I think Rupert Lowe did spend time being the chairman of Southampton Football Club. And I definitely met one chairman of the Southampton Football Club. I remember because he offered me a job. Interesting people coming in out all the time. And I would chat along with them, and a number of them would think, oh, like this young man, lots of potential there. So maybe I'll offer him a position. And I do remember I was offered a job at this football club, but I had to refuse it on the basis that I don't know anything about football and I don't find it remotely interesting. I think it's a silly game. So some various other things sort of came up there. It was also interesting that, I met, who was her name? Oh, Priti Patel, recently the Home Secretary. I thought that she was a vapid social climber and hold to that view. I met a number of the characters who would later appear in this last but one run of government, the last Tory run. And at the time, yes, my impression was of a lot of them was weak. The older characters, the grandees, they were quite good, but I mean, they've all died off now. But the younger cohort coming through, I didn't think much of them, and was proved correct in that view, quite evidently. But yes, the other thing about working on a political campaign was that you got to see how much the papers lied about everything. You know, they just basically make stuff. One particularly poignant example was the campaign received a fairly large check from somebody. And anyway, they looked at this and they thought, oh, yeah, we can't really, it's just too much, can't take it. So, yeah, they had a bit of a discussion. And then the check was handed to me. And they said, right, okay, go across London and return this check to the owner and say, thank you very much. Appreciate, blah, blah, blah. Can't take it. Reasons. And while I was on the way there, I stopped at a newsstand to see the first edition, because it was late in the day by this point, to see the first edition of tomorrow's newspapers. And the tabloids were going after this. And they basically had everything wrong. I mean, there was a nub of it that was true, which was, you know, a cheque had been sent or something like that. But every detail in the story was wrong. The amount was wrong. You know, the whole sequence of events was wrong. And I'm stood there reading this newspaper about this story with the bloody cheque in my pocket at the time. It's like, they just made it up. You know, they took the germ or something, they just made it up. So, that was the first of many examples where I've come to see that legacy media is just, quite honestly, is trash.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.